Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and all through this membership drive on the media's Brooke Gladstone has been coming on to talk about themes from her new book about the media called The Influencing Machine, and we've been focusing on different forms of media bias. Brooke is back with us one last time today for an expanded edition, and also joining us is the illustrator of the book, Josh Neufeld, who drew Brooke as media superhero, among lots of other things. Hi, Josh. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And let me, Josh, we'll get to you in just a second. One of the first panels, because this is a visual book, in the introduction is of the characters from The Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow, Dorothy, Toto, the Cowardly Lion, and the Tin Man, all standing in front of a warped mirror with Brooke pulling back the curtain. So, Brooke, tell us more about that image and the metaphor behind it. How did you come up with that visual, or did he?
Well, this particular image had everything to do with sort of the fundamental idea of the book, which is that we really do see versions of ourselves in the media, and when we recoil, it isn't just necessarily because of the distortions, but the image is distorted, nevertheless is based on some reality. Well, I would love Josh to address this because this was one of our earliest images. This is when we were getting to know each other, and it went through a number of iterations.
Yeah, it's true. I was thinking this was one of the few images that we actually did have a little bit of conflict about while we were working on the book, and I just didn't quite get, I think, the concept that Brooke was going for. So it actually went through a couple of iterations, and I think you were much happier, I hope, with the final one.
Yeah, absolutely. I just never felt that the reflections reflecting back to Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and so on were menacing enough. So we ended up turning the Scarecrow into a smoking
hooligan,
you know, and a Scarecrow smoking, right? That's terrible. And Dorothy looked like some scary character from Alice in Wonderland, and there were fangs on the lion and a razor blade mustache on the Tin Man and so on.
And some of the first panels of the book detail the history of journalism, starting out with the Mayan scribes and jumping to Julius Caesar's decree that the actions of the Roman Senate be printed and distributed. So let's talk a little bit about those panels, because right away the book starts out with really striking and at times very funny visuals. Like, what's the difference between the Mayan scribes and the reports on the Roman Senate?
Well, the Mayan scribes, there was another controversial panel when we were getting to know each other, and also one where I'm actually doing Marie Antoinette and holding my head in my hand. This is, Josh is a very wonderful person, and he doesn't like to draw women violently. And I kept pushing him to have me tortured and show my naked neck with my head off of it and just generally abuse me. There's one point where I'm sort of all twisted up. And, you know, I think that he had to work against a kind of an instinct to treat the avatar of Brooke more gently in the book than I wanted. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe my one problem as a cartoonist who does comics for grown-ups is that I tend to try to pull away from the typical imagery that you see in most exploitative comics, I would guess. And so in this case, Brooke had to keep pulling me back towards the really sensationalist images.
Media, sensationalist, exploitative. Interesting. Josh, the whole idea here is a graphic nonfiction book, like a graphic novel in cartoon panel form, but for nonfiction. Have you drawn anything like this before? Are there other graphic nonfiction books, or is this the first?
Oh, no, this is definitely not the first. Brooke, first of all, talks a lot about how this book was influenced by a book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud, which is a graphic novel comic book about comic books and how to read and understand them. And my own work has been nonfiction for my whole career. I was an illustrator for Harvey Pekar's American Splendor for many years, and I did a book a couple years ago called A.D., New Orleans After the Deluge, which is a true story of Hurricane Katrina and the a cross-section of people from New Orleans who lived through the hurricane. So there's a long tradition, well, at least 25 years. Of course, Mouse, everyone knows
and
about
Persepolis.
Art Spiegelman's book.
I think that the big difference with what makes this book unusual, though not the first, because Understanding Comics does it, is that it isn't essentially narrative-driven. Most nonfiction books have a story to tell. Usually it's a chronology. It's a memoir. There's Joe Sacco's done war reporting that way.
Right, it's an argument.
A.D. was a collective biography of seven very or six very different, you know, people who suffered Katrina. This book is almost entirely about ideas. There are moments of narrative, but there isn't a, you know, a single story or central characters that can unfold in chronological time. There's hopping back and forth, and that's what made this book, I think, challenging to structure and probably challenging to draw, because Josh had to draw from every single era and pull in details from everywhere.
Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, and Josh Neufeld, illustrator of their new book together called The Influencing Machine. And you include several metaphors in the book. One that really stood out is a donut. Why is a donut a good way for you, Brooke, to describe a journalist's world?
Well, I'd love to say that was original with me, but other people have described the sphere of consensus that way. David Hallin, who is really an historian of journalism, talks about how there is an area. If you picture a donut, the part that's on the donut is the part that's in debate, that's in contention, that that reporters love to sink their teeth into. That might be election coverage and policy stuff. But there are certain things that are within the donut hole, that empty space. Those are things that are already decided. You don't argue about whether the Constitution is a good document or whether we should bring back slavery. Generally, that's motherhood and apple pie stuff. This is the stuff where there are unquestionable values and unchallengeable truths. The stuff that is way outside the donut is the stuff that you can't discuss because it's too extreme. So, basically journalists hew to the sphere of, to the donut around the sphere of consensus. But that moves through time. I mean, once slavery was in the sphere of legitimate debate. So that's why I use the donut. And I get to eat it in the book.
So, Josh, how did you deal with all these metaphors visually? The very title of the book, The Influencing Machine, is a metaphor. And I wonder if that's easier or more difficult to master as an illustrator.
Well, really full credit goes to Brooke, because she pre-visualized this script. I mean, she wrote the script out like you would for a screenplay for a movie, and really detailed what she wanted in each frame. And my job was to actually, draw that. So in a way, she was the writer-director, and I was the DP or the actors, I guess, in this movie that we made. But the thing that I wanted to avoid when we were bringing to life a lot of these abstract ideas was just to stay away from the sort of editorial cartoon cliches that you see of, capitalists with big hats and cigars, or Congress people wearing a button that says Congress on it, or GOP. So we avoided those kind of tropes, and I think did a pretty admirable job of getting a lot of these difficult ideas across visually.
Without signs. I often wanted to use signs, and Josh stood firm on that.
Yeah, no signs.
Did she at least share the donut with you?
Yes, of course.
And we've been talking in our series with you, Brooke, all through the membership drive about different kinds of bias in the media, as you address in the book, and we've discussed the visual and the narrative bias. Let's talk about another one right now, the commercial bias that you point out, especially in light of the reports about the personal lives of those Roman senators who we mentioned before. You're right that this is the biggest bias. I guess it goes all the way back to coverage of Roman senators' orgies.
Exactly. And I mean, news needs to be new. We crave novelty. And so, as a result, we have to report stories that are exciting, even if it isn't of any significance at all. I mean, I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said, news is reporting that Lord George is dead to people who never knew Lord George was alive, right?
Right.
Like, oh, God, some lord is dead.
Or too bad of 9/11 to interrupt a perfectly good Shark Week.
Yes, precisely, precisely. So, you know, it leads to all the other biases. And certainly it leads to visual bias, and it leads to what I call bad news bias, because we're wired to care about anything that remotely threatens us. So we can get really excited about, you know, socialism or anthrax or SARS or dirty bombs, and it almost doesn't have anything to do with the reality of those fears. In fact, we know that crime is going down, but crime coverage is going up.
Josh, did this idea of commercial bias enter your thinking at all when you were writing AD, New Orleans After the Deluge? Because of their, you know, of course, there was so much important coverage of Hurricane Katrina, but there was so much sensational coverage too, and such a temptation.
Oh, sure. I mean, a big part of why I wrote AD, or included one of the characters in it specifically, was a woman who had lived through the experiences at the convention center, which got a lot of coverage. The Superdome and the convention center got a lot of coverage during the period right after the storm, that there was all of this chaos going on, and there were roving gangs, and there were rapes, and children were being molested, and all sorts of violence that turned out to be almost 100% false. And these were just rumors that were being spread and then being accepted as fact. And they were great TV. You know, they made great coverage for the networks. Unfortunately, like I said, about 99% of those stories were not true. And unfortunately, I think, as you've talked about on this program many times, people remember the first incorrect news and don't remember the correction comes later. So I added this character in AD to correct the record, at least for posterity.
And when you laid this commercial bias book at the foot of it being news, at people being interested in what's new, is that the origin of the word news, by the way, do you happen to know? Is it just the plural of new?
New? I don't know.
I'm going to tell you the news.
I would think so, but I don't know. I mean, how could it not be?
Some people say it's northeast, west, south, because it encompasses everything. But I think it's the plural of new, after all. But then we have these kinds of cases, like the disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor in Japan, going on since March 11th. It was intensely covered when it was new. It's still going on, but it's not in the news very much anymore. The floods along Mississippi, which continue to devastate the South, but now we're into the tornado in Joplin. Not that that shouldn't be covered, but it's what's new, and we don't see the aftermath of the floods anymore, even though that devastation is still going on and complex and requires choices and everything else. The fighting in Libya goes on. We heard a lot more about the decision to start the fighting. So these are examples of
exactly.
That bias.
Exactly. I mean, much smaller likelihood that reporters will return to a story, which really damages our understanding of events, is the biggest problem with this, you know, news bias towards news, commercial bias, in that it leaves us with a very false impression of the world.
So, Josh, I want to thank you very much for coming on with us. And again, congratulations on a really great book. It's really fun to read. And everybody I know in the media who's taken a look at it thinks they're learning from it, as well as that other people who consume media should see it. So great job on the visuals.
Thank you very much.
Josh Neufeld, illustrator of the book The Influencing Machine. And we're going to take a break. And Brooke is going to come back for one final thought as we conclude this series, as we take a little graphic nonfiction book look at the possible future of journalism. So stay with us. And by the way, that includes how science fiction influences Brooke Gladstone's approach to the media. Stay tuned. WNYC, and now we conclude our Membership Drive series with our own Brooke Gladstone, host and managing editor of On the Media, about her brand new book, The Influencing Machine, which is about the media. She argues, among other things, that instead of a machine which controls us, the media is really a mirror which shows us a reflection, though often warped, of ourselves. So where does the mirror go from here, Brooke? And the way I'm going to frame that question is there are a lot of science fiction references in the book.
Yeah.
From The Matrix to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to the transition between the real and virtual worlds known as singularity. So what's the connection there for you between media and science fiction?
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of media, what we can do today at the, you know, flick of a finger is absolutely unimaginable even back in 1979 when Douglas Adams wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, he described the guide as having 100 tiny flat buttons and a screen about 4 inches square on which any number of a million pages could be summoned at a moment's notice. I mean, big whoop, mm-hmm. right? We all have that now. He wrote, "It looks insanely complicated," which is one of the reasons why it had the words "Don't panic" written in large friendly letters. And really the message of this book, of The Influencing Machine, is we don't know what's around the corner, but don't panic.
But you're right that everything we hate about the media today was present at its creation. But do we hate it more or in a different way through today's technology and the economics of today's technologies?
Actually, I don't think we do. I think that smart people who are around every time there was a new technology very, very eloquently condemned it as bringing the collapse either of civilization or of human cognition. And the fact is that it does change how we're wired. Most anthropologists believe now that it isn't just that we make tools, but that tools make us, that man first picked up the club, then he got good at walking on 2 feet, then he developed smaller teeth, then he developed a bigger brain, not the other way around.
And on this idea that the media is really a reflection rather than an influencing machine at all, does that let journalists off the hook too much? Because, yes, the public has its biases and, you know, commercial demands will force you to do one thing or another because otherwise your newspaper will go bust or whatever the pressure may be. But ultimately, here we are as individuals with some amount of free will, I would argue, as journalists, and we have to make the right ethical choices for accuracy, for fairness, for all those things that we value or not.
You know, it doesn't let us off the hook at all because as every single individual, I think, has a responsibility to at least try to be the best person that they can be. Every journalist has to try and be the best journalist that they can be, the most honest, the fairest, the clearest headed, the person who can explain things well and increase the sum of human knowledge in the world. I mean, whatever it is that defines a good journalist, that's what you should be. And then that reflects back on a better humanity.
You talk about the shift from objectivity to transparency in the book. It used to be that journalists would defend themselves by swearing that they were impartial third parties who were just reporting the facts. But now reporters seem to be stepping away from that model and closer to disclosure, transparency over objectivity. You like this, right?
Well, I think this is I've always felt that there was a certain amount of willing suspension of disbelief to simply not say who you voted for, that is enough to reassure the audience that you don't take a position, right? Whatever your audience is, viewers, listeners. I don't think that this shift has been made, actually, the one that you describe in mainstream media yet. I mean, I think that this shift towards transparency is much more a creature of the new media. And journalists of our generation were reared under the old system. So I don't think for most of us, we think transparency has replaced just keeping mum about what it is we do and how we conduct our lives in order to increase the trust of our listeners.
But when you talk about transparency replacing objectivity, and in the context of our whole series on bias,
I see that coming around the corner.
If we're moving to a transparency rather than striving for objectivity model, might that not increase political bias? Because then people will be freer to say, oh, well, I'm disclosing that, you know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, and so my coverage of the issue is going to be this. I mean, I think that's the big knock on Fox News is that they're not transparent, right? They say they're about being fair and balanced, but they're really conservative. But what will be left of the attempt to be objective? Will we all just fall into our political silos if we say, well, I'm telling you what I believe, so it's okay for me to report the news through that lens?
Well, I don't know that you should necessarily report. You're right. There is a concern that if you say, oh, well, if this doesn't matter anymore, I can report any way I want. But that still gets back to my point, is that you have to be the best journalist that you can be. I think the biggest knock on Fox News isn't just the hypocrisy behind the fair and balanced slogan. It's because the information that's imparted on so many of those talk shows is so bad. I'm not even talking about the newscasts, but the talk shows, some of that information is just wrong. It's bad. Studies by Pew have shown that people who watch a lot of these shows are ill-informed, have wrong ideas about things, and people who consume other news, especially I say modestly, National Public Radio seems to produce the most informed news consumers, but it's the quality of the information that's the problem.
And she says that without any bias whatsoever, I guarantee it. Brooke Gladstone, her new book is The Influencing Machine. Coming up next, Romeo Dallaire joins Leonard Lopate. He was Lieutenant General of the UN Peacekeeping Force in Rwanda in 1994. Brooke, thanks for a great series.
Thank you, Brian.
And a great book, The Influencing Machine. Brian Lehrer on WNYC FM and AM New York and WNYC.org. Machines, they keep right on moving. Machines, machines, they keep